we just bat things around and I'll do a little probing and talk sure. about you and talk about
Gladly.
The things you've done.
Sure.
You had a pretty good review in the Times. I clipped that.
Uh-huh. Did better on the Sunday.
When was that?
That was the next, the 25th. That was terrific.
I missed that one.
He compared me to Thorstein Veblen. Laughable. My favorite. The guy, Thorstein Veblen, Theory of the Leisure Class. One of my favorite writers. Anyway, he hemmed and hawed, but finally he said he really liked it. So it was a money quote. So I was happy. So, it's kind of, it's a contentious, it's an intentionally contentious book, and I'm pleased that, you know, when you push, you get pushed back. But it's been good.
Tell me what automatic vaudeville means.
Automatic vaudeville is you'll see from the opposite of the title page is a photograph of a penny arcade at the turn of the century on 13th Street and 3rd Avenue called Automatic Vaudeville. And I love the title. I just like the phrase. Of course, in my family, the word vaudeville has a lot of resonance. And what it was a penny arcade. And in the penny arcade was a sort of variety of entertainments, of different kinds of shows. You could watch melodrama, you could watch comedy, you could have travelogues. And in finding a title for a series of essays which link together have the common theme of celebrity in some form or another, how it affects talent, how, you know, in some sense criticizing talent and also discussing the careers of various artists like Sondheim, Noel Coward, Joe Orton, the Beatles. I thought that it captured the sort of variety, the energy, and the sort of fun of debate that I like to have, you know, when I'm doing it.
I was a little surprised to see that you had included the city, the great city of Dallas.
No, not surprised at all, because that is a city that really wants to become a star. I mean, the city is dying to be famous and to be renowned, and is the whole pitch of the city is to celebrate itself and to be celebrated by great architecture and bringing in great theater, to be a world, to have a world reputation. The whole impulse of the city is, as a person, as it were. I mean, the impulse of the sort of founding fathers of the city. Anyway, so it works. And in the metaphor of automatic vaudeville, in those entertainments were many different kinds of entertainments. You know, documentary history or something. I mean, you know, little pictures like little newsreels, mini newsreels. So it's possible to have. It fits within the metaphor of the title, anyway.
Now, a lot of the personalities that you have included in Automatic Vaudeville, you had not met. You had met some of them. You had mentioned that. But what about, say, Noel Coward? Had you ever met him?
No. I've written a book on Noel Coward. Mm-hmm. But personally, I never met Noel Coward. Although, of course, I read his stuff and listened to his songs and know something about him. But I really didn't get into the world of Noel Coward until I wrote a book about it.
Would you have liked to have known him?
Sure. I think he would have been. I gather he was a very charming man. And I think I have a bead on him as a sort of artist. In the Frank Rich's review, he was kind enough to say that the take I have on it may well be definitive. Well, it may not be definitive, but it has to do with charm. It has to do with hiding behind this this very carefully worked out persona that he had from the age of 22 till he died and catered to and joked about in his plays and present laughter. It's all about his charm. And if you read the plays, the word charm, the insistence on charm and this mask is absolutely debated and insisted upon. And in fact, when they asked Coward how he would be remembered, he said, by my charm. And I think he was very right.
You told me about some people that I had not heard of and probably should have because obviously, Lieber and Stoller.
Well, I'm surprised you don't know about them because your listeners will know, if they don't know them by name, they'll know them by their songs.
Of course. But I never associated human beings behind
yes.
Hound Dog.
I know. Well, there you are. They wrote Hound Dog. They did all the coaster songs like Poison Ivy, Little Egypt, all those terrific songs, and the Elvis songs, you know, a lot of terrific things. And they are connected. That's my little mash note to the 50s, where it's just my period growing up, and all their songs, especially the Coaster material, is what I grew up to. And I love that music. I mean, I love it for the sort of energy in it.
Well, you and I are not that far apart in age, and I also grew up with that music, and I can't imagine how we could be so far apart in our appreciation of the music of that era. I thought it was awful. And as a matter of fact, our sister station, which is up on the 17th floor, WCBS-FM, plays that music. It's the golden age of rock and roll, they say. But there is something simplistic about it.
I'll say.
So pre-Beatles.
Oh, for sure. We're not talking about art here. We're talking about life. We're talking about yearning. We're talking about, those inarticulate expressions of feeling, of passion, of longing. I mean, Lieberman Stoller wrote Kansas City, for instance. Which the Beatles then recorded. As they did most of Lieberman's, or a lot of Lieberman's Stoller songs. It's a feeling of anticipation. It's nothing to do with quality, although the songs, in the sense that they are pop culture. I mean, whether we think that they're skilled or not is irrelevant. The point is that the culture absorbed them, and that for a generation pre-Beatles, a lot of people measured time by those songs, where they were, what they did, and then when the Beatles came along, we remember where we were when we first heard, you name the song, and it's how songs operate that way. They are, for a lot of people, how life is remembered. They are the spell, and they literally are a spell, I argue in other parts of the book, that creates our sense of happiness. I mean, Plato wrote in Laws that songs were spells to create concord, harmony. And that's how they function in our culture, and also how we receive them to a large extent. I mean, look at how Cole Porter songs or Gershwin's songs are, are the sort of high points, the fantasy points, the sweet, mythic points that our parents say remember their young years. You know, I think it's just generational. It happened to be that when I was growing up, it was Little Richard and Lieberman Stoller, but you know that was what
you get. Our generations by the fins on the backs of the cars.
Yes, that's true.
The holes in the fenders of the Buicks.
That's right. Well, that's pop culture, isn't it? It's what's going. It's what is of the moment.
I liked particularly the article you did on Stephen Sondheim, and you have many selections from his music, and even without the music, you can sit here and read things like Streams Are Dying, Mix a Potion, Streams Are Dying, Try the Ocean, Brilliant Notion. It's so poetic.
It's funny that you choose that quotation. I use that as an example of bad lyric writing. There are many Sondheim songs, like Something's Coming, Something Good, If You Can Wait, which... that's early Sondheim, before he discovered disillusion. But nonetheless, it is the condensation of an idea that's deep in the American musical, the sort of sense of expectation, the longing for something to happen, the belief or the insistence on believing that something will happen. And I think that that's poignant, and he gave it poignant expression, as, for instance, Everything's Coming Up Roses, which in the show that it's in is a bitter song, but extrapolated from the show becomes a sort of paean to hope, which the musical, although he would deny it, essentially is. And that's why it is the essential, as I argue in that essay, it's the great American art form, but it's also the great political art form in theater, because it is the... It mythologizes the status quo. It mythologizes the belief in abundance, the belief in hope, the belief in staying still. Something's coming, something good, if you can wait. Which is conservative with a small c.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that Notes on a Cowardly Lion has been reissued, very timely.
Thank goodness.
About the same time?
Yes, I have to say, by Limelight Editions. Are doing for me and for other lucky people, lucky enough to be republished, a very great service. Notes, when it first came out in 1969, had a very long life. It was the actual life of a book in a store, ironically, is 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And Notes was in print in both a hardback and paperback edition for 10 years and then went out of print. So this is like a little rebirth of this book, which is very important to me since A, it was my first book, and B, since it's about Dad. And it's very important to me that it be in print. I think I would have paid the publisher to put it in print because I so much want another generation who might be interested in the theater and might be interested in him.
It's a wonderful book, but somehow it must have taken a lot of courage for you to write it because your father was still alive at that time.
Yes, it didn't take courage, but he didn't actually ever read the book, and he died a week after I finished it. And I doubt, as I say in the new preface, that he would have liked it when he read it, but he would have liked it once he read the reviews. He's such a guarded man, so guilty about his life, so insecure that he would have just thought that he was opening himself up, or I was opening up himself up to great public censure, since every star is his greatest invention. In a way, each great performer invents himself and his persona. I think they try to guard it and protect it, and silence is one of the ways you protect it. But really, it wasn't a matter of courage as much as a matter of necessity. It was the only time I realized somehow that I would only get to know my father if I wrote a book about him. It was the only way I could relate, he would relate to me.
Would you have wanted him to read it?
Oh, of course. I think he would have enjoyed it at some level after the fact. I think it was important also because, in a way, I knew that I was mourning him even as I was writing it. I knew that he wasn't going to live forever, and here I was trying to write and put down on the page something about how this man came to be. And up to that point, when I started to think about writing the book, which was when I was about 22, he was a mystery to us. We didn't know about him. He didn't like to talk about his past for reasons of the great tragedies in his life and mistakes he felt he'd made. And he just didn't want to go into it because his first wife went crazy, and it was a great and enduring scar in his psyche because he never quite understood why this happened. It had a lot to do with the kind of pressures and paradoxes of celebrity, which I discuss in Automatic Vaudeville, but that's another matter. So to get to try and penetrate him and find out about him was a way of really coming to terms with someone who was really in his own house, almost an art object. We all admired him, and that was our way of dealing with the fact that he ignored us. Now, as an adult, I feel a bit more critical than I was, I think, than when I wrote the book about that attitude toward family. And again, it's something I discuss a lot in
did you sit down with a tape recorder?
I talked with him. Very often he'd call me up on the phone, and we'd have conversations, and he'd say wonderful, funny, odd things, and I just write them down and file them away and then keep them and think about them and try and put a shape to them. But yes, absolutely, I'd go over with a tape recorder and say, now you're going to tell me about this thing, and then he'd tell me a lie, and then I'd go out and find out the truth, and then I'd come back and face him with the lie, and then he'd sort of tell me the truth, and we went back and forth like that, you know. But it took me 5 years to write the book, and I had, I must have done 100 or 200 interviews, not only with him, but with people. And they were, as it turned out, a lot of these old-timers were dying off, you know, old vaudevillians who never lived to see the book come out. But since Dad was a star in every form of American entertainment, barring radio, and even then he had his own show, it just wasn't that successful because he's so physical. He gave me, as a critic, a chance to analyze him in the context of the genres that he was in. So he represented the best of, very often the best of genres, but burlesque. He was the last Ziegfeld Follies, did the last big Broadway review. He was the first clown to really do legitimate theater in Waiting for Godot, which he premiered on Broadway. So there was a lot to discuss, so that it becomes, inevitably, even without wanting it, a sort of history of American theater in a way. And I've gotten a lot of letters over the years from people who said that the book was nice, but what they really liked was the appendix with all the all the old vaudeville sketches. And that's good. I'm glad they say that, because it's very rich. It's a little thought kit for people. And yet it was very odd and interesting when it came out and when I was promoting the book around the country. I would do a lot of talk shows where they call in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And people would say, well, that's not, the guy you're describing is not Bert Lahr. I mean, you know, I knew Burke Lahr, and he was a very genial, warm, friendly guy. And what is interesting about that is that you see, again, the spell of celebrity that I'm talking about in Automatic Vaudeville was I was experiencing even then in my dad, because people, he went very deep into the public consciousness, and they had a very intimate relationship with him and his sort of public persona. And yet I know, I'm very confident about, that the guy in those pages is him. That's his voice. That's what he talked like. And 15 years on, that's very comforting to know that he's there, you know.
What you say is probably very true, and I ask this not in a critical sense, but it takes a certain amount of presumption, effrontery, and I don't mean this critically, to get inside Burke Lahr the way that you did, so that you could say, Lahr believed this, Lahr felt this, Lahr wanted this.
Well, yes, but you know, you first of all, it would be fair to say that the act of writing, or just raising your voice above anybody else's, is an act of great egotism. Now, I can take that point for starters, but I'd also say that I lived with the man in the same house for 27 years, and so that it's not, I mean, you know, I can. While it's true that one can't know philosophically what anybody means at any one time, I think it's fair to say that it's not fictionalized in that sense at all. And it is very often, a lot of all the dialogue that's reported as his between us is absolutely verbatim. And it's lovely now to go back and see that the syntax, the outrageousness of the man, the preposterousness, which was terribly unfunny to him offstage, funny to us, because we were watching him try to swat a fly or put on his earphones and watch television at the same time. And he was a preposterous. Once my wife, he was ill, and he wanted some chicken soup, and we brought it to him, and he tasted it, and he spit it out. He said, there's salt in this. I mean, he was just a tyrannical will of a star was born out in him, except that he was lovable in some way, and the panic that he was able to communicate with an audience, the sort of shared terror at life, the sort of vulnerability which Ngong 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 calls up in people, was there always. And as I said, 15 years on now, in this third edition of the book, it's wonderful and reassuring to me to just know that that's him, that's his pulse. And if people want to feel it and feel the man, it's there, you know.
John Lahr, you were 27 when you wrote Notes on a Cowardice.
Yeah, I worked on it for 5 years.
How did the publication of that book change your life?
Oh, I think by about 180 degrees. I'd been working on it for 5 years. My wife and I were living in two rooms. We were just taking odd jobs and living on nothing. And the book came out, and I couldn't understand why there was no review in the Sunday papers. And I was really worried, because the first review I ever got was the Christopher Leemenhaupt's review. And I got up at 7 o'clock and went out, and he sort of pronounced that I didn't understand my father. And I threw that review in the waste paper basket, and I was shattered. And then there was no review in the Sunday Times, and I thought, well, I'm down the tubes. And the next week, Harold Klerman wrote about it on the front page of the Sunday Times magazine, and the book was launched, and it got, as you can see, phenomenal reviews, and continue to get them. And it changed it in the sense that I suddenly thought, being a writer was almost an impossible dream to me. And I thought, my wife and I used to go for walks or play baseball, have catches in the park, and say, gee, all I want to do is have one book published. Then, of course, after this came out, it was not a matter of having one book published, but let's go. You know, we would launch. And that sort of started me out on, I became the critic of The Voice and Evergreen Review, and I don't think I looked up from my desk for 5 years, which is a bad thing. I was really repeating the very pattern of my father, which was to sort of drive everyone around him crazy with his own ambition. And gradually over the years, mainly by moving to England and concentrating on work and family and nothing else mainly, I've broken that pattern. But essentially what it did was to give me and my kind of writing and my approach to theater, a real viability, and get an audience for my writing, which was, you know, it made my name such as it is.
Well, fill in some holes for me. You started the book when you were 22. Were you in New York at that time?
I went to Yale and Oxford, and while I was at Yale, I did a summer internship at the Miami Herald. And the last piece, I loved that. I would get up at 6 in the morning, see my byline, and drive around in my Volkswagen and have my picture taken in booths with a cigarette, trying to imagine me being a foreign correspondent. But the last piece was a wonderful reporter down there, my mentor, called Al Burt, who said, why don't you write a piece on your dad? And I did. It was called Notes on a Cowardly Lion. And over the years while I was at Oxford, I toyed with this and wrote a few chapters and got married at my last year at Oxford. And then afterwards I said, I said to my wife, Anthea, I've got to show you this. I'm writing a book. And Anthea comes from a family of writers, read it and said, John, this is terrible. This is no good, this book. And it wasn't. It was very poetic and overwritten, and it was sort of just Baroque. So I started again. And I started from the first page, and I worked on it and worked on it, and we got it up to scratch, you know. And the writing, I mean, I'm just beginning now, 20 years on, to feel that I can get a sentence right. And it's just an apprenticeship, you know, and I'm really interested in writing and the process of it and getting shape to ideas and moving people with words and making, surprising them in different ways by making them laugh or making them cry or saying something that outrages them or just getting it right. And that's a long process of trial and error. But essentially, after that, and after this book, I was the critic for The Voice, which was very interesting and too powerful, probably, and for Evergreen Review. And with that, I was literary manager of Lincoln Center.
What is that job?
That was good. That's, you know, choosing the plays, working on the plays. So I was in a position at one point, very briefly, for about 6 months, where I could review a play, get it published, and mount it at Lincoln Center at the same time. And that happened on a few occasions. But that was not long-lived because it was too much pressure and I wasn't doing enough work. I was caught up in the very kind of celebrity automatic vaudeville discusses again. And gradually, because I was commissioned to write a book on Joe Orton, we started spending more time in England where Orton was an English farceur who was murdered in 1967, and I had to do a lot of sleuthing to do that book because there was a diary he left of the last 6 months of his life, but not a whole lot of other information, so I had to really dig. And that took me 5 years to do. And in that time of digging and living between cultures, we had a son. And the combination of growing up, having a child, moving back and forth between cultures, but seeing really that life for us was much more viable in England than here. I mean, to live in New York and do the kind of writing I do, I would have had to write a lot of things to make money, which I wouldn't have wanted to write. Whereas I can live, and if you can believe this, I live on $70 a week in London, and well.
How?
Well, just because you can. If you exclude my apartment, which I bought because I sold one of my novels to the movies, you can. I mean, society's organized differently. I mean, your education and your health are taken care of by the state, so you don't have the same insecurity in that way. So it's just food.
And as I was appalled by the prices the last time I was in.
Yeah, well, if you're living in the center of any metropolis, they're going to see you coming, aren't they? I mean, it really isn't at all difficult.
It struck me that I can't remember the economics, but I think it was a couple of years ago. But I think I read someplace that the average weekly salary for a secretary or an average person was something like $35 a week, $40 a week.
No, that isn't. Altogether true.
Well, I'm,
it's low. What you're projecting is low.
It's very, very low. At any rate, whatever figure it was, I'm guessing at this. Because it's been a while. I just wondered how anybody could afford to come in town and see a play. I guess the theater prices were somewhat lower than.
Yes, they are.
Than New York.
The answer is, I'm sometimes amazed too. I don't see how anybody can go out to meals when meals are sort of like $30 a piece. You know, that seems to be given the lower amount of English wage. But what I'm trying to say is, it suits us. It suits a lot of American writers. Robert Coover was over there for a long time. Wonderful writer, and for the same reason, you know. I mean, you can work, you can concentrate on your work. They're not the same kind of financial pressures. And also, they're not the same kind of financial rewards. But that has its advantage because you notice that a lot of English writers tend to write a lot, the reason they write a lot is that they have to earn a living. And that's good. Very often, we take a writer like Erica Jong, a writer has a big book or two, and they make more money in those two books than they'll ever need in their life, really. And it kind of throws them out of whack. And there's no need to write. They're public figures. They're names. They have all the money. There's no impetus to do anything but sort of take a bow. And someone like Graham Greene, whose success came quite late, actually, in his life, commercially, you know, has to turn out at once a novel every 2.5 years. So the economic pressure helps that, I think.
Yeah, so many English labor. You mentioned Noel Coward, who spent most of his life outside of England when the latter half of his life, and indeed Dick Francis does his writing in Florida. So many, and Paul Theroux was.
He's living in England.
Yes, but he was telling me that so many Britons, when they acquire any amount of money at all, they leave.
Well, it
they
varies.
They don't want the money taken from them, and they leave. They go.
Well, some now that's you can say, you can argue that, and I could give you examples. I mean, of other people who stay. I mean, there's nobody. None of the writers you mentioned are half as wealthy as Paul McCartney, who stayed. And he'd rather write a check for £3 million to the Internal Revenue.
He can afford to stay.
Well, so can Noel Coward. Listen, any of those guys will do just fine, thank you, on what they earn and pay to the tax. You see, it's a political argument, but essentially, if you live in the society and the society is functioning for everyone, you're part of that society, and it's right that you should commit, not, as we do here in America, try and pay as little to the society as possible. It's right, keeping as much for us, but see yourself as a member of society, and your success and the blessing of your success contributes to those who are a little less successful than you, but no less deserving of education or health, which are not privileges, but rights of people, I would argue. So,
did you read Thoreau's book, Kingdom by the Sea?
No, I haven't read it.
Well, if you do, his thesis is just the opposite. He indicates in this book that indeed there is a terrific morale problem and a cultural failure in England, that that people there really don't care about each other to the extent that you would think the British would. Their crafts, their production, so much of their famous output has diminished in quality.
Well, I think it's an argument that's the nicest thing you can say about that argument is that it's debatable. I think you could argue it as hard from the other point of view. His point of view is a very interesting and available and often spoken conservative point of view. There's evidence to the contrary. You know, it just depends on where you sit politically and what your idea of human behavior and moral behavior is. There's a great deal of a range of argument in between. It's certainly a very interesting place to work in. And Coward, there was a great deal of odium attached to Coward's leaving England, for example. It was thought very bad that he did that. And I think it affected his own particular sensibility immensely, because I don't think he was completely out of touch with the society entirely. Entirely. He was just no idea that society between 1945 and when he died in 1976, I think, underwent major social changes. And he had no idea of what had gone on, because the world that he was reflecting and the elitism and the talentocracy that he represented and sort of made him, sort of was the sort of president of the talentocracy, all these famous talented people who were his wonderful friends, was a thing of the 20s and 30s, when he was the style. He set the style for that period. And it changed. And he couldn't reflect anything except this kind of archaic elegance and charm and good manners, which in certain context is very violent, when it discounts other people, when it thinks fondly that it, because he is who he is, he's slightly better than other people. Which is one of the problems with celebrity, that no matter how you cut it and how nice you want to be, and he was very nice, the bottom line is that the famous spend an awful lot of time measuring the distance between themselves and other people, and that leads to isolation and no community at all, and that's sad and destructive.
Just a last question or two. How do they treat you in England?
treat me. Mm-hmm. Just an ordinary bloke. Nobody knows my name. Nobody knows Dad much. That's nice. They know I'm a writer, and it came when I told them I was going over to America to go on some talk shows, and they said, oh, terrific, you're a kind of celebrity. And I don't tell them that I spent, you know, when this book was out, I must have crisscrossed America three times on the Johnny Carson show and the Cabot show. They don't know about that, and it's not important. And I like that because it makes me realize that it's what I do. It's just a job, and my job is to do it as well as I possibly can, but my job is also to be a good father and a responsible member of the community. And I don't think, in the context of American life, I would have discovered that, because the society doesn't reinforce that. They want the touchdown. They want the work. They don't want to know about anything but the individual accomplishment. And that is it's in America especially, the artist and the famous artist essentially serves to romanticize individualism, to romanticize accomplishment. And my point, even in the introduction to Automatic Vaudeville, is that all life is collaboration, and in some way or another. And being abroad has helped me both it's wonderful to be detached from a society for a while. And, you know, some of the essayists that I most admire have benefited. I mean, I'm not putting myself in their class, but certainly they've all benefited from something that I've benefited from, this detachment. I mean, Gore Vidal, Susan Sontag, Mary McCarthy, James Baldwin, they write very trenchantly and with a kind of an angle which comes from getting outside the deliriums of a culture and seeing it from a different perspective, from a sort of a less parochial perspective, and that's refreshing. It's refreshing to come back into a culture and just, everything seems very glistening and fresh, and the problems that oppressed you when you were in the culture, you're vaccinated from, in a way. It's very odd and interesting. And what's oddest of all is, especially if you've been, as you are if you go to an Ivy League school, if you're groomed to be a winner in the culture, if you're groomed to be inside, as you are, and they tell you you are. They tell you you're special. They tell you you're looking at, look to the right of you and look to the left of you. Those are the leaders of the future. That's what they said to me anyway at Yale. When you're outside where you're living, you come back to your native culture and you're also outside. You're strangers in both worlds in a way. It's scary, but it's an existential way. It's more real. It's how you die. The illusion of nationalism. It's illusory that. I mean, you do feel free, and you do feel, and it gives you writing. I noticed a great difference when I reread recently some of my earlier criticism and, say, Automatic Vaudeville. The difference in the criticism, over and above the fact that over 8 or 10 years you learn to write better, is that you don't have anything to lose. So it makes what you say, it makes you say what you really mean. You're not playing politics. You can be daring. You can be dangerous. Because nothing has a claim on you. And that, to me, is very liberating.
There are a couple of writers who have told me in the past that, James Jones is a case in point. He was an expatriate in Paris for a while, and he decided to come back to the United States in the early 70s and made his home in Long Island. And he said he felt left out of things. It was very seductive being in Paris, and he had a beautiful view from his window. But he felt that the United States was the center of the world.
No, I find that, funnily enough,
to come back.
Yes, you know, it's very interesting. Funnily enough, I don't. Now, of course, that may change. But I find, in my study of American history, I find in some way that the basic mechanism of American life, if you read de Tocqueville, who after all made his trip through America in 1835, de Tocqueville's view of America is like deja vu. It's absolutely accurate about the psychological, emotional problems of this culture. It's as if he was here now. That the sort of constellation of the subtext of American life is always the same. It doesn't change. And democracy works slow. It takes a long time for things to change in any kind of substantive way in the culture. so that the surface changes, but the actual underpinning of it doesn't change so rapidly. That's one thing. But I think that a lot of things that are happening in the culture, I mean, in the world, Americans, because of the nature of, I have to say it, the networks and how they receive their information very often, they don't know about a lot of the things in the global, on a global perspective. You know, a lot of the things that might be going on and are indeed going on, say, I don't want to get into this altogether, but in Nicaragua, it doesn't come. It's not as much in the debate that goes on in this culture as it should, I think. Anyway, I'm using Nicaragua only as an example, but there are just lots of things that are going on.
Are you familiar with a young writer by the name of Mark Helprin?
Yes, yes, I am. I'm Snow.
He wrote the Winter's Tale.
Winter's Tale, right? Yes, and a book of short stories. I am.
Yes, he's written A Dove of the East.
Right,
and
very
Wallace
good
Island,
writer.
And other stories.
Yeah.
And
terrific writer.
Yes, he's excellent. He said two things. One would jive with exactly what you said about going to Yale. He went to Harvard. His contention is that Harvard did not offer him a better education than, say, Ohio State would have offered, but that Harvard has the knack of selecting the leaders of people out of school who have already been successes in their adolescence, and they have a pretty good idea that they can be trained to continue these successes in the future. That's one thing he said. But the other thing, and I think you, in effect,
I agree with
said
that.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing you would disagree with him about, in Winter's Tale, he had a scene which he ultimately excised, and it was between, oddly enough, an Englishman and a New Yorker. The Englishman, who had, as Helprin said, voted with his feet to come to New York, was highly critical of America and its culture, but stayed here anyway. And Helprin had a character in which he said, whether you believe that New York is good or bad, whether it's dirty or clean or evil, violent, it is the place, according to Helprin, where Western civilization is working things out.
That's wrong, I would say. I would think it was totally, that's where Western civilization is coming to an end. What you want to look for is where people are starting to redefine what individualism is, where people are starting to cooperate rather than compete, where they're trying to find new ways, not thinking about how to live differently, but living in a way to learn how to think differently. I would disagree with him, but what I do think is that the debate that I enjoy is what I do believe is that criticism is a kind of loyal opposition, and it's really healthy to wade in there and debate it hard, just because there is no right and wrong, but there is in debating it hard. People in this culture, I think, very often feel that if you debate fiercely, you are being aggressive or it's unfair or something, because generally in the press, anyway, it's either hype or nothing. But it isn't. It's a dialectic, and it's a way you sort out what you feel, and you come to terms. It's a way of finding out what you think. And I think that's what writing is. You don't know what you mean until you've said it, if you see. You sort of are trying to grope your way to some understanding of cultures, and I find it very interesting and confusing to be straddling two worlds. But I find, I'm finding it, I'm suddenly seeing my life more as a journey, and I like the sort of sense of setting out and not knowing where I'm going, whereas had I stayed in this culture, I knew where I was going, because the ground plan was well set up for me even before I started. And that's the nature of, you know, the elite that Mark Halpern was talking about. It's a self-selecting group. And once you're in the group, they can perpetuate it, and they do perpetuate it by sort of sending you, in a sort of obvious way, if you were in a secret society, as I was. When you graduate from Yale, like at Skull and Bones, I wasn't in Skull and Bones, they not only give you money when you go out of Skull and Bones, they give you a booklet of Skull and Bones graduates who have jobs. Oh, now if you apply for a job, they know that you're from Skull and Bones. So in other words, it's like any secret society. It is a sort of self-perpetuating elite, which is nice if you're on the inside. It takes a little while to see that it's wrong and it's violent, and it's the game is rigged.
Mark, we've been talking much more than I had intended. I only have a little show. We've been talking almost 45 minutes. But how often do you get back?
I come back at least twice a year.
Twice
a
year?
For long spells. I mean, I'm back here now to teach at Colorado College for a course on Tennessee Williams for a month.
Oh.
And then I come back in the summertime with my
Do you have
family.
Reentry problems at all?
Do I? No, not at all. I mean, the first thing I do when I get back, I did this morning, I get up at the crack of dawn, walk around the streets and go into a diner and load up on coffee and pancakes and just listen to people talk. That is the one thing, as we're going on here, I'll just want to say one other thing to you. The one thing that one really misses is the wonderful poetry of street talk. Just the rhythms of it when you're in America, people in England talk terrifically and clearly and great sort of vivacity in their own idiomatic expression. But there is a difference. And the difference is that the idiomatic expression in America is very democratic. That a president and a wino will both be talking about hanging ten and deep sixing. There's a kind of, so that the language cuts right across classes, where in England, the idiomatic expression varies from class to class, and it's very, if you're a writer, it's almost impossible to know, as one should, match the right word with the right class. But here it's much more democratic, and I really crave the sludge, you know. I mean, I love it.
The row, I had to keep. He's my most recent link to England, other than yourself, so I hate to keep mentioning him, but he did say that in many instances he found that Britons were afraid to talk to strangers because they would reveal their class by their accent.
I think that's true. I think that's true, although, you see, from where Thoreau is sitting, which is not from where I'm sitting, Thoreau is America's idea of the writer abroad, and he's promoted that image. He's sitting there and as an established writer hanging out with his established coterie of friends. I don't hang out with writers because I think writers together, and I think most writers agree, are boring. I mean, you know, I'm the whole idea in the culture is to. It's much more democratic, I find.
You ought to hang out with Helfrin. He says the same thing.
Yeah, I mean.
However, I have a feeling that Helfrin and you are politically diametrically opposed.
Oh, I doubt it. We probably meet somewhere in the middle.
Well, I don't know. I have a feeling that
he's a civilized man.
Much more liberal. Viewpoint toward things, and Helfrin I perceive as much more conservative. In fact, I noticed there was an article he wrote for the New York Times Sunday Magazine called The Case for Nuclear Deployment.
Well, definitely, I think he might have a few problems going here.
But this is not manifested in his work. His work is decidedly non-political, and I could not tell his politics at all by reading his material, which is quite gripping and quite lovely, overdone in many instances. Well, listen, we really talked more than I had anticipated.
Well, it was a pleasure anyway. Nice to have a good talk.
It was fun to do that. I enjoyed throwing the ideas off of you and having you throw them
back. Well, if it makes a decent show, terrific.
Thank you very much for coming in. I certainly enjoyed your work.
Well, thank you for saying so.